Another guilty plea today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort pleads guilty in federal court to two charges, including one count of conspiracy against the United States.
This charge really encompassed the full range of financial crimes, reporting crimes that he had been accused of. It was all sort of wrapped up into this broader conspiracy to defraud the United States.
And later, a filmmaker from Kabul tells the real stories of women in Afghanistan.
The image of Afghanistan and Afghan women was always about like oppression and victimhood and other issues which are really true. But what we did was we showed all the things that we were enjoying living in Kabul.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. President Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, pleaded guilty to two charges in federal court today. He accepted a plea deal and agreed to cooperate with the investigation led by former FBI Director Robert Mueller. It was a dramatic twist in the case. Manafort had been facing a second trial after being found guilty on eight fraud charges at his first trial last month. We've got BuzzFeed reporter Zoe Tillman on the line from Washington. Zoe, what did Manafort plead guilty to exactly?
Paul Manafort pleaded guilty to two counts, the first being conspiracy against the United States. And this charge really encompassed the full range of financial crimes, reporting crimes that he had been accused of. It was all sort of wrapped up into this broader conspiracy to defraud the United States. And the second count was conspiracy to obstruct justice. This was essentially a witness tampering charge where he was accused of trying to reach out to potential witnesses earlier this year to basically influence what they would tell investigators about the nature of his lobbying work, where he was saying to them, you know, remember our work was only in Europe, not in the United States, when prosecutors said that he was in fact orchestrating lobbying efforts in the United States and not registering as an agent for a foreign entity. So there were a lot of different allegations that were wrapped up and encompassed in these two counts that he pleaded guilty to.
And just to be clear, these counts that he pleaded guilty to have to do with his lobbying and work in Ukraine, not the Trump administration. Remind us what his work was in Ukraine.
Starting in the mid-2000s, Manafort represented the pro-Russia political party in Ukraine. He represented various political figures who were members and leaders of that party, including Viktor Yanukovych, who would go on to be the president of Ukraine. And that work included organizing political campaigns in Ukraine, and then more sort of relevant to the DC case, doing lobbying work and public relations work on behalf of the Ukrainian government at the time in the United States.
Paul Manafort's lawyers had said there was no chance of a plea deal. Do we know what changed?
What we know are the circumstances, which is that we were on the eve of his next trial here in Washington, D.C. Jury selection was scheduled to start first thing Monday morning. The other difference is that he's coming off a series of eight felony convictions in the Eastern District of Virginia, where he was previously on trial earlier this summer. They convicted him really of all the categories of allegations against him there. So he was coming off what was really considered a loss out of the Virginia case and going into what was gearing up to be a multi-week trial that would again delve into his finances. So he was in for the long haul if this hadn't happened today.
How is this case connected with the probe into possible collusion with Russia, that investigation led by Robert Mueller?
There isn't a direct link between what Manafort was charged with and the allegations of collusion between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. There's really nothing about that in the charging papers. It's related in the sense that Paul Manafort was the former campaign chair, you know, but for that role, he probably wouldn't have fallen under the purview of Special Counsel Mueller's office in that investigation. But we do know that he is now cooperating with the special counsel's office. He's waived the right to have his lawyers with him at any future interviews. So whatever they want from him, he's now agreed to give it.
What is next for Manafort himself?
Paul Manafort, first and foremost, will be going back to jail. He's been in pretrial detention since June. He has gone back today and will stay there for the time being. The prosecutors today asked for 60 days as sort of an initial period before they file a report with the court. He's agreed to delay sentencing until his cooperation is finished. So 60 days puts us at the next report is due November 16th. And then from there, prosecutors can either say, we're done, we're ready to go to sentencing, or they can say, we need more time, which is what we've seen with other cooperators like former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, former campaign advisor George Papadopoulos, where there were sort of lengthy periods of cooperation where sentencing was delayed. So we really don't know what's next. We just know that Paul Manafort is now on the list of individuals within the president's orbit who have agreed to cooperate with what the special counsel is doing.
BuzzFeed reporter Zoe Tillman. Thanks, Zoe.
Thanks.
Today's other big story, of course, Hurricane Florence. The massive storm made landfall in North Carolina today and is still blasting the region with flooding, high winds, and power outages. It's a powerful storm made even more powerful by climate change. Our warming atmosphere is supercharging storms everywhere. It's simple physics, really. Hurricanes and tropical storms run on heat, and that's what global warming is all about. One study released by researchers at several major U.S. institutions this week estimates that human impact on the climate system could increase rainfall from Hurricane Florence by as much as 50%. That kind of impact adds urgency to the fight to tamp down climate change, especially as the Trump administration throws the federal government's policies into reverse. That effort's been the focus at this week's global summit in San Francisco, led by California Governor Jerry Brown. Brown's positioning his state as a leader on climate action in both the U.S. and internationally. The World's Carolyn Beeler is in San Francisco and has this report.
When President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement last year, cities, states, and business leaders across the country rushed to jump into the leadership void. Chief among them was Jerry Brown, who announced in a video just weeks later that he would host a global climate action summit.
Yes, I know President Trump is trying to get out of the Paris Agreement, but he doesn't speak for the rest of America. We in California and in states all across America believe it's time to act.
California had already made big cuts to carbon emissions, and Brown pledged this week to make the state carbon neutral by 2045. But how much can a single state actually lead globally on a problem like climate change?
What have we done to the world? Look what we've done.
Well, by the time a gospel choir sang to open this week's summit, Brown had assembled quite the group of high-level international leaders. There were several heads of state and environmental ministers, CEOs of big multinational companies, and perhaps most significantly, a big delegation from China.
The fact that China sent a very high-level delegation, that was huge.
Angel Xu is a China environmental policy expert at Yale.
I mean, Minister Xi Jinhua has led the Chinese delegation for many years at these international negotiations, and so he came, brought a huge Chinese delegation. I mean, that's really significant.
A partnership between China and the U.S. paved the way for the Paris Agreement under President Obama. Now, with President Trump having turned his back on climate action, Xu says Brown seems to be the American half of that key relationship.
It almost is like China and the U.S., they haven't missed a beat in this bilateral partnership on climate change because California has really stepped in to fill the role.
But California is just a state. So how much can its efforts really matter?
It matters.
Xu Qi heads Energy Foundation China. He points out that California's economy is bigger than most countries.
The top five economy in the world, and also so many states, they continue to follow the Paris Agreement. This is sort of encouraging.
And at the conference, Brown extracted new promises from states, cities, and businesses to cut carbon pollution.
Today, I am pleased to announce that the Australian Capital Territory, along with nine other additional jurisdictions, are joining the Powering Past Coal Alliance.
10 new states and countries committed to phasing out coal entirely. More than two dozen governments and businesses set targets for zero-emission vehicles. 73 cities pledged to go carbon neutral by 2025. Promises were made to green ports, protect forests, and invest in battery storage for renewable power.
Give them all a big round of applause.
No one's tallied up the impact all these flashy new commitments could have, but everyone here in San Francisco seems to agree that Governor Brown's summit has helped reinforce collective resolve.
To me, Governor Brown is a climate hero.
Todd Stern headed up the U.S. negotiating team during the Paris process.
I think that this summit's been very useful. It's a demonstration of activism. It's a demonstration of will. It's a demonstration of engagement by all sorts of subnational players. And I think that's all been tremendously useful.
But, Stern says, and it's a big but,
it doesn't fill the gap of the absence of the United States at a national level.
Here's just one example of why. New data released this week show that voluntary promises made by more than 3,000 cities, states, businesses, and nonprofit organizations will get the U.S. less than half the way to the pollution cuts it promised in the Paris Agreement. But unlike that patchwork approach, federal policies like the Clean Power Plan would have cut emissions in all 50 states.
The U.S. federal government can drive action all around the entire country, not just state by state.
Piecemeal solutions make it harder to reach a national climate goal, which in turn makes it harder for a nation or a state like California to lean on other countries to do more, even when scientists know the current goals aren't enough to avoid a climate calamity. That may be why Governor Brown used this analogy more than once during the summit.
Everywhere you look, there's a challenge. That's why I use the metaphor, we're at the base camp of Mount Everest, and we're looking up to say, there's where we got to go. It's about that difficult.
The real reckoning of how successful Brown has been at pushing action on climate likely won't come until 2020. That's when countries have to up the ante on their carbon-cutting pledges under the Paris Agreement. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, San Francisco.
All this week, we've been hearing from people who've traveled to San Francisco for the climate summit, people who are bearing the brunt of this crisis. Here's one more voice from Sri Lanka.
My name is Jayathma Vikramanayake. I am the United Nations Secretary General's envoy on youth. So I'm from Sri Lanka. Growing up, I have seen many impacts of climate change. For an example, the raining patterns have changed, and we are a society that is heavily dependent on agriculture. And often on the TV growing up, I would see news about farmers suiciding, killing themselves because they couldn't produce enough crops to feed their children. So as the UN's youth envoy, one of the things that I do is to make sure that in all the climate-related conversations that we are having, we make sure that we include young people as equal partners, because most often we tend to keep young people on the side of the beneficiaries, thinking that they're not able to do things by themselves. So the idea is to really get young people as equal partners. But I think on the climate issue, it is about us having to live in a world or us having to be leaders of a world that we did not create. So really holding the former generations to account for their decisions is very personal to young people. But on the other side, I'm also extremely positive because of the young people that I meet. And I have not met a single young person who does not believe in climate change or who does not take climate change seriously. I have seen young people questioning the clothes they wear, questioning the products that they eat, the products that they use, questioning the way they travel to work or school. So in that sense, I think there is a strong conscience in young people that we shouldn't leave the world in the way that we found it. We should make it a better place for the future generations to live. And on the other side, we have no other option. If this generation does not reverse these implications, then we are going downhill. So that is my call to action.
We have more profiles of people living with the consequences of climate change on The World's Instagram. We're at PRI The World. Still ahead, The Economist's editor-in-chief on why she has to speak to Steve Bannon. You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Time for some light conversation now about the future of the free world. Seriously, though, there's a lot of anxiety out there about a series of threats or perceived threats to the liberal democratic world order. The rise of populism, the return of trade protectionism, and the decline of old alliances, to name just a few. So where to go from here? The Economist magazine is tackling that question at a forum in New York tomorrow, and one of the speakers scheduled is former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon. That's raising a lot of eyebrows. It comes after The New Yorker invited and then disinvited Bannon to its annual festival this year after angry protests. Zanny Minton-Beddoes is The Economist's editor-in-chief.
So the festival we are having tomorrow, the conference we are having tomorrow, is the culmination of this debate and discussion we've been doing for the last 6 months on the future of liberalism. We've been doing it online and in videos and in podcasts. And in it, we have been talking to people who support our worldview, but also to critics. And tomorrow's event, I felt, was very important that we had somebody who epitomized a worldview that was utterly antithetical to ours, so that we could not just hear that view and challenge it, but have that as the backdrop, if you will, or the context of the discussions for the future of liberalism. Because otherwise, if you have really just like-minded people talking to each other in an echo chamber, then I think you miss out on part of the challenge that liberalism faces today.
What about the argument that by talking to Bannon, you're giving a platform to bigotry and intolerance?
Well, I will certainly call out Mr. Bannon on that, and that's clearly what very many people think. But the bigger point, I think, is that what he stands for is a view that is held by large numbers of people on both sides of the Atlantic. It is not an extreme fringe view. It is much more than that. The way forward is to have open debate where you can expose the weaknesses of the other side's argument.
You've written a long essay for The Economist's 175th birthday. Essentially, it's a clarion call to reinvent liberalism for the 21st century. Define for us what liberalism means.
Liberalism, I'm afraid, is now one of those words that means different things to different people and sort of creates unbelievably powerful reactions in different people. So to be clear, by liberalism, we do not mean the sort of leftist, big government progressivism that it means in the US. What we mean is the classic British liberalism that was behind the founding of The Economist in 1843. And its real tenets are a commitment to open markets, limited government, a universal commitment to individual dignity, and a faith in human progress that's brought about by debate and reform. But what it does stand very clearly against is nativist nationalism.
What's fueled this current drift away from liberalism?
I think there are several factors going on. Within the West, both sides of the Atlantic, I think there is a sense of disenchantment and anger at the state of the economy and at the fact that living standards for many people have stagnated. I think the aftermath of the financial crisis was a big part. There's also a sense that societies are changing very fast and a number of people feel that they are being left behind and left out. So there is a sense of frustration that ordinary people have. There is also a complacency that has set in, I think, amongst what is often derisively called the liberal elite, but the people who have been in charge because things have gone wrong. And it's worth remembering that over the past 200 or so years, liberalism has succeeded because it has serially reinvented itself. Liberals are at heart reformers. They want to improve the world. They believe that reform will improve the world. And the current challenge we face is that I think many people in the governing elite have become less liberal than conservative, if you will. We've lost the sense that there needs to be reform, the agitation for change. And what we're trying to do in this manifesto is to lay out why we think society does need to change and what we need to do to sustain the free markets and open societies that are so central to a liberal democracy.
I want to pose this to you. I mean, some might say that the remedy for right-wing populism is to push forward with a more radical agenda from the left, to fight more for social justice, for the redistribution of wealth. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, I think the right way to counter both radicalism on the left and radicalism on the right is with radicalism from the center. And I agree with those who say on both the extreme left and the extreme right who are dissatisfied with the status quo and who think there needs to be change. Our 10 pages are about ideas for change. Where I differ from the extreme populist nationalist right is the goal. Their goal seems to be a build walls, close off, ethnically driven them versus us worldview, which I think history shows us is antithetical to prosperity. It leads to potentially violence. It's a very dangerous road to go down because we just need to look at what happened in the 20th century. On the extreme left, I think there's a similar problem. I think history has shown us that sort of radically leftist ideas and a very big state also don't work. And so the sort of strength of the traditional liberal agenda is that it's not revolutionary, it's evolutionary, but it is agitating for reform. And it's agitating reform that is incremental, but nonetheless quite substantial. And a large leap to the extreme left, I don't think will end up putting this country in a better place.
How does liberalism fight back? I mean, what's your prescription for saving the free world, if we want to be hyperbolic?
That's a big... Well, I think the... Let's first of all put some perspective here. We don't have a prescription for saving the free world. We have a few, we have some ideas, and we've put together in these 10 pages some ideas of what a reinvention of liberalism should look like. I think the first step for all of us to do is to acknowledge what the strengths are of the liberal position, what the strengths are of liberal democracies, and why they are worth saving and supporting and sustaining. Secondly, a fairly cool and hard-headed look at what's gone wrong. Where are the weaknesses? Where have we fallen short? What needs to be changed? And then thirdly, reasoned debate about what those changes are, whether it's education, whether it's rethinking taxation and the welfare state, whether it's thinking about, you know, how do you make markets more competitive? How do you attack vested interests? How do you make sure that you minimize, you know, concentrated power and crony capitalism? On an international level, and we haven't talked about that yet, but there's another challenge, which is for the past 75 years, what's always called the liberal world order was set up by the United States in the aftermath of World War II and sustained by the hegemonic role of the US. Now we have two worrying trends. One is the rise of a very illiberal China, and secondly, an unwillingness, certainly by this current US administration, to play that role, and a view that it's not in the US interest to do it, and a more zero-sum view of the world. And I think we have to think hard about what a liberal world order looks like and how do liberal democracies sustain it. And that's in addition to the kind of domestic rethink. So it's a pretty big agenda. There's a lot to do, but the stakes are extraordinarily important. You know, we've had the longest period of peace, certainly in Europe, in the last 75 years, for many, many centuries. We've seen enormous prosperity around the globe from the spread of liberal democracy, the rules-based order, from free trade. And that's a lot to have at stake. And we, you know, it's our responsibility to make sure that that's not lost.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes is editor-in-chief of The Economist. Happy 175th birthday.
Thank you very much.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. A husband and wife wanted Canada to recognize their indigenous tribe. Their quest involved a cross-border elk hunt.
I was like, are you serious? Oh, yeah, we'll just strap it on your back. You can get it. And I'm just thinking to myself, holy crap, Annette, what the hell are you doing to me? Trying to kill me. But we got it out.
That story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Today, we wrap up our week of coverage from Afghanistan with a story about a fierce young woman. Sahar Fetrat is a 22-year-old documentary filmmaker from Kabul. She's also an activist for women's rights. And as she told The World's Shirin Jafari, her foray into activism started when she realized the power of a camera.
Sahar Fetrat is running late. The young filmmaker is supposed to meet me here at the opening of a new bookstore in Kabul. But she's still on the set of her latest documentary. So I wait. In an open-air courtyard, a band plays. This place has a kind of hipster vibe, Kabul style. Men with trimmed beards and skinny jeans sip tea. Young women in colorful headscarves and immaculate makeup mingle and chat. After an hour of waiting and people watching, I finally spot Fetrat. She has a boyish style and an infectious grin. Her spiky hair juts out of her loose headscarf. After catching her breath, she tells me how she got her start as a filmmaker. Fetrat was just 15 when she first picked up a camera.
It was a Philips camera, a small one. It looked like a cell phone.
She used it to shoot a video for a school project. She and a group of her girlfriends were assigned to record their day-to-day lives.
It's 2011, but I think the image of Afghanistan and Afghan women was always about like oppression and victimhood and other issues, which are really true. But what we did was we showed all the things that we were enjoying living in Kabul.
What started as a school project turned into a series of short documentaries. Over a year, Fitchat shot 6 videos, each about 10 minutes long. She called them Kabul cards. There's this grainy, shaky video where Fitchat is behind the camera, recording her friends as they try on clothes and put on makeup in a shopping mall. There is plenty of talking over each other, hugs and giggles.
Now you mean
This is how Fitchat fell in love with filmmaking. At first, it was fun, something she would do with friends when they hung out. But over time, she realized that this piece of technology is powerful.
I mean, for me, it was a very good realization that I can use camera and storytelling to tell the stories of Afghan women.
She started to include social commentaries in her videos. One issue that fired her up was the street harassment she and her friends endured on a daily basis. Here, Fitchat asks a cab driver why he thinks men harass women on the streets. It's their fault, the driver says. When they dress immodestly, they trigger men. Fitchat says she and her friends learned to use their cameras as weapons. The moment men catcall them on the streets, they'd whip them out and start recording.
We used to hold the camera and tell them, you'll see yourself in TV, and then they would be like really scared, or like some of them would apologize, or some of them would, you know, react differently. But I think that experience itself showed me how empowering holding a camera and being able to tell the stories is.
Fitchat's documentary about street harassment got a lot of attention. So much, in fact, that she was invited to talk about it on national TV. When the host asks Fitchat to talk about her personal experience, she chokes up. Remember, at this point, Fitchat is just 17. Street harassment has taken a serious toll on my well-being, she says. As a young woman, I struggle with this every day. Five years later, Fitchat is a documentary filmmaker, and she refers to herself as a feminist. She dedicates the work that she does to her mother, who passed away last year.
Whenever I think about feminism that I believe in, I think of my mother, who till the day that she passed away, she didn't even know what does feminism mean. But I think the way she lived, the way she carried herself, and the way she brought us up showed me how many feminists were inside her.
This fall, Saha Fitchat is off to Budapest, Hungary, where she begins a master's degree in gender studies, something she has dreamed of since she was that 15-year-old girl with a flip camera in her hand. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Kabul, Afghanistan.
If you want to see Sahar in action and more great photos from Shirin's reporting in Afghanistan, check us out on Instagram. We're at Women's Lives, one word. A new law took effect in Morocco this week. It criminalizes various forms of sexual violence against women. Supporters call it the culmination of years of work. Critics say it falls short of what's needed. Stephanie Willman-Bordat is with Mobilizing for Rights Associates, an international women's rights group based in Morocco. She spoke to us while out on the street in the capital, Rabat. Stephanie, your organization has lobbied for years for the passage of a law protecting women in Morocco. Are you satisfied with this one?
We're not at all satisfied with the law that was enacted and went into effect this week. In collaboration with local women's groups and activists working at the grassroots level across the country, we've been campaigning for the past 12 years for a comprehensive violence against women law, and this law falls short of all of the advocacy efforts.
Now, tell us what the law says and then where it falls short.
The law creates two new crimes of sexual harassment and technology-facilitated violence. So now, under the law, the catcalling, sexual harassment in public spaces is illegal. And then harassment of a sexual nature via social media, via mobile phones, via other forms of technology is also criminalized.
And why do you think that falls short? What were you looking for?
Well, the first major weakness is that the law does not provide any concrete services or support to women victims of violence. The second major gap is that it does not change any of the existing laws related to rape and sexual assault.
What does that mean?
It means that women, in order to prove rape, have to have physical injuries. And then the second problem is that sexual relations outside of marriage are still illegal. So women who dare bring a rape complaint and then can't prove that they didn't consent, they risk being prosecuted.
You lived in Morocco for about 25 years, and for many of those years, you've been working with Moroccan women in the fight for women's rights. What are the most problematic kinds or pervasive kinds of abuses that women are subjected to?
Well, there was a national study conducted in Morocco that indicated that one in four women in Morocco will be a victim of sexual violence in her lifetime. And that's just what was reported. 7 out of 10 women have experienced some form of violence just within the last 12 months.
And what kind of violence are we talking about?
The violence, 55% of the time, takes place within the family home by the spouse. Physical abuse, deprivation of financial support. There are many, many cases of deprivation of food, of water, refusal to support the wife and children financially, expulsion from the family home, marital rape, of course.
You're critical of this new law, but do you think that it's a good thing, even if it's limited, that it represents progress?
Yeah, the law, the strong point is that it's provoking discussion on the issue of sexual harassment in public spaces and pushing forward the conversation about what's appropriate behavior towards women on the street. And the fact that technology-facilitated violence got included in the law is quite forward-thinking because there's many states in the United States that don't adequately cover technology-facilitated violence yet. So that's a good thing. The issue, of course, is the law is not going to be able to be enforced, and then the law does not put into place any protective measures for women. So women who have suffered violence in the past, who are at risk of future violence, are not going to find any measures that are going to protect them under this new law.
Stephanie Willman-Bordat has been speaking to us from the streets of Rabat, Morocco. She's a founding partner of Mobilizing for Rights Associates, a women's rights organization in Morocco. Thanks a lot, Stephanie.
Thank you very much.
We've got one more story from Morocco now. It's about a former American diplomat named Kathleen Ann Krieger. This past July in Casablanca, she died. She'd lived there for decades. Krieger left the U.S. Foreign Service to start a business there, and it became the second largest tourist attraction in the city after the Grand Mosque. You may have heard of it. It's called Rick's Cafe. And yes, the place was inspired by the fictional nightclub from that 1942 movie. Edlene Sear had a chance to meet Krieger at Rick's last winter and has this appreciation.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss.
Kathy Krieger was a born diplomat and entrepreneur. She lived in Japan, the Czech Republic, and eventually moved to Casablanca, Morocco in 1998, where she worked as a commercial attaché for the American embassy. Ironically, all her adult life, Krieger nourished a passion for the classic movie Casablanca, starring Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart.
Why did you have to come to Casablanca? There are other places.
I wouldn't have come if I'd known that you were here.
When she arrived in Casablanca, Krieger was surprised that no one had bothered to create a Rick's Cafe, just like the nightclub run by Humphrey Bogart's character Rick Blaine in the movie. So Krieger began thinking she should take on that project. I met Krieger in Casablanca last December when she told me that it was the 9/11 attacks on the United States that prompted her to launch what she saw as a different kind of diplomatic mission.
Because I thought it would be a symbolic move after 9/11 to show how different Morocco was and not to be put into the same basket as maybe people would be perceiving everybody over in this part of the world. And also to show something good about Americans and give a place for Americans to feel comfortable.
In her mid-50s, Krieger quit her government job and bought a dilapidated traditional Moroccan riad, or mansion, on the edge of the city's rundown old quarter. It took a year to restore and turn the building into a venue inspired by the movie's café. Her splendidly restored mansion, flanked with palm trees and lavishly decorated with marble floors, mosaics, and ornate lamps, opened as Rick's Café to great fanfare in 2004. When I visited there last December, Krieger showed off the main dining room inspired by the film.
The bar is the same shape as the bar in the film, only it's much more elegant, with leather armrest and marble top and the gold palms in between the columns. And then with the arches and the lighting and the shadows, it gives off that same ambiance as you see in the movie.
Krieger's glamorous venue helped raise the international profile of the city and still attracts visitors from all over the world, from locals to diplomats to movie stars. The cafe's longtime manager, Issam Shaba, says this gin joint has become a destination. It quickly took on a life of its own, which no longer needs any reference to the film to exist, he says. In fact, I think it's prettier than what you see in the film, and it's not a kitsch place where you come to take selfies. On most evenings, Krieger would sit in the corner of the bar with a view of the dining room. She was an elegant and slim woman with short salt and pepper hair, whom many here called Madame Rick. She also liked to laugh. At the bar one night, she told me she'd uncovered a bit of a saucy chapter in her old house's past.
Mysteriously, our back stairs on the other side are incorporated into the building next door, which was a bordello. And we think these back stairs could have been like a back entrance to the bordello. Or at least we like to think that.
Krieger often quoted scenes from the film, like the one where Rick, Humphrey Bogart, tells Ilsa, Ingrid Bergman, he doesn't mind dying in Casablanca.
I'm sorry, but you are our last hope. If you don't help us, Victor Laszlo will die in Casablanca.
What of it? I'm going to die in Casablanca. It's a good spot for it.
And then it really happened to Kathy Krieger. On July 26th, she died after a stroke and a heart attack at the age of 72. Her manager, Issam Shaba, says he will keep Rick's Café going and Krieger's legacy alive. In the end, many people may come here not because of the film, he says, but because of a very real character this time, one who turned a dream into reality. This Sunday, friends of Kathy Krieger will gather in her hometown of Lake Oswego, Oregon, at a movie theater to remember her. They will show the film Casablanca and play jazz music from Rick's Café to honor her memory. For The World, Adeline Cyr, Boston.
In about a month, it will be legal to buy and sell marijuana in Canada. The recreational cannabis industry north of the border is building up to this big moment. Many Canadians are already investing and looking for other ways to enter the business. Of course, weed is also legal in some parts of the U.S., but it's still illegal under federal law. And according to U.S. officials, Canadian marijuana users, workers, and investors risk being barred from entering the United States, maybe even a lifetime ban. Louisa Savage is the executive director of Politico Pro Canada. She broke the story yesterday. Louisa, what's the significance of this announcement?
Well, this is the first time we've heard the most senior official responsible for border operations at U.S. Customs and Border Protection detail exactly how they're going to deal with Canadians after Canada legalizes marijuana on October 17th. The problem is that millions and millions of Canadians cross the border into the United States. And if they are asked, have you ever used marijuana? Or if they are asked, what do you do for a living? And they say, I work for Cannabis R Us. they face a lifetime ban from entering the United States.
So did Canadians not know this until you broke the story?
I think there have been anecdotal stories of people going into the United States and being turned back and facing these lifetime bans. And I want to emphasize what they said to me was not that they're going to interrogate every single Canadian traveler about whether they've ever used pot. However, they said if they see signs or clues, they won't ignore those clues and they will ask.
So here's another hypothetical. A Canadian man or woman crossing the border into Washington State. They get stopped. They get asked. It's determined that they work in the weed industry in Canada. They're entering Washington State where pot's legal. They could still be banned because it's a federal law.
That's the bottom line. The border is under federal law, and under federal law, marijuana is strictly prohibited.
Just to be clear, this is not about the Trump administration. This is a law that was simply on the books, and suddenly people are realizing, or you broke the story, that, wow, this could really affect a lot of Canadians.
Absolutely. And CBP emphasized that to me as well. This is not something that the Trump administration has invented. This long predates the Trump administration.
If you're Canadian and you get banned for your involvement in the cannabis industry when you're trying to cross the border, is there a way to appeal?
So there is a waiver process. It costs $585 and it takes, I'm told, 6 months, and it's at the discretion of CBP. So if they decide, okay, so you smoke pot once in college and you haven't done it since, we'll make an exception for you and reinstate your ability to cross. But there are no guarantees.
Louisa Savage is the executive director of Politico Pro Canada. Thanks a lot, Louisa.
Thank you.
Finally today, what do you do when someone has officially declared you don't exist? Well, according to the Canadian government, the indigenous Sinext tribe does not exist. But there are thousands of Sinext descendants living across the border in Washington State. About a decade ago, one of them decided to challenge Canada's declaration by hunting an elk. It all wound up in court with some setbacks and some victories. Emily Schwing of the Northwest News Network has the story.
First, the victory. About a year and a half ago, more than 50 Sinext tribal members gathered outside the provincial courthouse in Nelson, British Columbia, to celebrate a court decision, one that affirmed a connection to their historic homeland. Members of the Sinext threw their arms in the air, whooped, hollered, and then paused as a fellow tribal member played a traditional honor song. The celebration was a long time coming. For almost a decade, Rick Desitel had been in and out of this Canadian courthouse. The Washington State resident had finally been cleared of charges related to hunting as a non-resident without a license in Canada.
I knew for a fact that my ancestral grounds were here.
Desitel lives on the reservation of the Confederated Tribes of the Colville in northeast Washington. But in 2009, he crossed the border into Canada to shoot an elk that would be used for Sinext ceremonies, weddings, funerals. His wife, Linda, helped him quarter and haul the elk out.
I was like, are you serious? Oh, yeah, we'll just strap it on your back. You can get it. And I'm just thinking to myself, holy criminally, what the hell are you doing to me? Trying to kill me. But we got it out.
She told the story to a crowd in Nelson last March during a celebration of the first anniversary of Desitel's acquittal. For Rick, Linda, and other Sinext descendants in Washington, it wasn't just a hunting trip. It was a protest.
I knew for a fact that if somebody didn't start this, and it's never going to get going and whatnot. And so when I was asked if I wanted to start this, I said, sure, I'll come up here and I'll kick up a little dust and see what happens here.
In 1956, the last Sinext member in Canada died, and the government there issued a declaration of extinction. As a result, the Sinext who regularly crossed the border lost their rights to traditional land claims in Canada.
And one of the big things that I wanted to get the invisibility of me erased, and so I can come back here and have some input on things that are happening in this country to save a lot of the history that's still here.
That history includes two centuries of conflict. White settlers started arriving in the early 1800s. Eventually, the Sinext were pushed across the border and onto the Colville Reservation in Washington State. More than 4,000 Sinext descendants live there today. Shelley Boyd is one of them. She comes from a long line of Canadian Sinext, and she testified at Desitel's trial.
There's been some moments in this past year
when we sat in the courtroom and heard the judge for the first time say that we were not extinct, that was ridiculous. I never thought I'd hear that in my lifetime.
The judge says Desitel was exercising an Aboriginal right that stretches back thousands of years. But the case isn't over. It's now before British Columbia's appeals court. The provincial government argues that the case could raise questions about the security of Canada's border.
Whether it means there's going to be hordes of American Indians stampeding across the border to shoot everything in sight.
Attorney Mark Underhill represents Rick Desitel.
And as I've been saying for a long time now, that's simply not the case. You know, this case was won, as I said, because of that undeniable truth that the Snakes were here. And that's not everybody's story.
We've contacted the provincial government multiple times for comment, but they declined because the case is still in the appeals process. So questions about reparations remain unanswered for now. But some observers say this small case about hunting an elk could set precedent for tribal sovereignty issues and Canada in the future. For The World, I'm Emily Schwing in Nelson, British Columbia.
And that's it for us this week. Our theme music is composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. See you back here on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.